The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
I wanted to tell you that I really like your show.
Hi, Chris. A huge fan of you and Fan Steady.
Good morning, Chris. Great show as usual.
A big fan. I listen every day.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
So desirous to make this empty vessel a historic figure. She is not a historic figure. Other than her genitalia, there's nothing about her skin color or genitalia unless you combine the two of them, and then I guess that makes her historic. But yeah, Politico so desperate to make Jackson Brown historic that they have to issue a retraction in an article discussing the pending likely confirmation of Jackson Brown to the Supreme Court. Politico falsely claims that she would have been the first black justice. Clarence Thomas had something to say about that. Direct quote, "Let's walk you through how the confirmation of Ketanji Brown Jackson to become the first black Supreme Court justice is likely to unfold this week," the story originally said. The word female has now been added. Telephone number 610-850-0990, 610-850-0990. We'll talk with Andrew C. McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, and our friend about the confirmation hearings. Not surprisingly, three Republicans have now signed off to say that they will vote to confirm her. Mitt, one of them yesterday. Does that surprise you? Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, the other. And then I told you yesterday about the warbler from Maine. Anybody surprised that Mitt Romney will confirm Jackson Brown? He issued a statement yesterday. "After reviewing Judge Jackson's record and testimony, I have concluded she is a well-qualified jurist and a person of honor. And while I do not expect to agree with every decision she may make on the court, I believe she more than meets the standard of excellence and integrity. And I congratulate Judge Jackson on her expected confirmation and look forward to her continued service to our nation." More than meets the standard of excellence and integrity. I suspect some child rape victims were unavailable for comment to confirm Senator Romney's position on that yesterday. But nevertheless, that's where things stand. We will speak to Andy about that coming up. Meanwhile, one of the attorney general out there that I really hope makes it to the United States Senate, Eric Schmidt, has joined forces with two other attorneys general across the country. Only two, so that makes three. Three states have issued the Biden administration a lawsuit over its plans to lift Title 42, a border policy that has led to the expulsion of the vast majority of people trying to file asylum claims in the United States. Who are the three states? You would think these would be border states. I'm a little surprised Texas isn't a part of this. Only one border state, Arizona. Louisiana, another, followed by Missouri. Now, Eric Schmidt is the Attorney General of Missouri. Like this guy a lot. A whole lot. Three Republican, he's in a dogfight of a Senate primary in Missouri. You know what's going on here in Pennsylvania with Dr. Oz and Dave McCormick? Eric Schmidt is in a similar fight in Missouri. There's a Dr. Oz, Dave McCormick-style fight in Missouri going on at the same time. It's amazing.
Chris, I'm a huge Schmidt fan. I would love if you could pull some strings and get him on this show.
He's
impressive. Yeah, I like him.
I'm a fan. I like him a lot. It's interesting, though, because Josh Hawley, who is a star in the conservative movement, shares the same. See, this is politics. This is politics. Josh Hawley, the senator in Missouri, shares a consultant, and all roads run through political consultants, as you know, in this game. Josh Hawley shares a consultant with a woman called Vicki Hartzler. She's a congresswoman in Missouri who's also running for Senate. So does it surprise you that Josh Hawley came out and endorsed Vicki Hartzler, the congresswoman for Senate in Missouri?
Politics. No, no surprise.
Even though, I'm not going to say anything. I will just say, because many friends listen in Missouri, and I'm trying to make good in Missouri just the same as I am here. I am not commenting on primaries. Speaking of Senate primaries, Dr. Oz will be here again today. And we're looking forward to catching up. New Real Clear Politics average of polls brings Carla Sands back into the conversation, ladies and gentlemen, moving her into third position. Now, this is the average of polls, just to be clear. This is no one poll. This is an average of polls. But the average of polls now has Dr. Oz, as I said yesterday, pulling to within one of Dave McCormick, who was considered once upon a time the front runner by a lot. But now Oz trails him by a point, and nipping at their heels is Carla Sands, who, to my knowledge, did not participate in the last debate we discussed. I don't know if she was invited or how that worked.
I had heard that she has pretty much declined to be on any stage with the other candidates. So, I mean, if she keeps doing that, she will not be a part of the conversation.
I don't know how we read that. But at any rate, Oz will be with us today at a little after 8. We'll ask him about this because, you know, Philadelphia is now threatening masks again. And so I'm just curious, as we now are being threatened with masks yet again, do you think Title 42, lifting Title 42, makes a whole lot of sense? Of course, it doesn't anyway. Let's see if I can find that story. I have a bunch. Yes, here it is. Philadelphia health officials have recommended that people resume wearing masks indoors following a jump in COVID-19 cases in the city. As we see more cases of COVID-19, everyone's risk goes up, says the health commissioner. That means now is the time to start taking precautions. Philadelphia health officials recommending that people wear masks in public indoor spaces to help thwart a growing number of COVID-19 infections in the city. The health department said in a press release yesterday, COVID in Philadelphia has increased by more than 50% in the last 10 days. This jump comes as COVID-19 infections in Philadelphia have been slowly rising over the last several weeks. As we see more cases of COVID-19 in the city, everyone's risk goes up, says the health commissioner. And so that means now is the time to start taking precautions. Philadelphia remains in the all-clear tier of the city's COVID-19 response. That means cases daily are less than 100. Hospitalizations are less than 50. However, the health commissioner has advised Philadelphians do have a stash of masks, should have a stash of masks ready. You have your mask stash ready in there, Fast Eddie.
Oh, yes. And I actually took a walk last night with the dog and the baby. Masks all over the place on Ridge Ave.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Now, is that back or they've been?
Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, like, on the ground, you know, ready
yeah. You know, I didn't get to that story yesterday about pollution. I meant to. Do you know how they're talking now? I've seen two stories in the last week about microplastics in our system. Have you seen these stories that scientists are now discovering we're just ingesting copious amounts of plastic?
Yeah, I heard about that.
Now, that's not the United States throwing a bunch of trash and litter into the ocean. That's a bunch of hellhole third world countries and a bunch of countries like China and India that don't give a rat's rear end about environmental standards. We're not doing that. That ain't us. And then take a look at masks. In fact, I remember a story last year that They studied the number of disposable masks that are out there floating around in the ocean now. So yeah, that doesn't surprise me. That's what you saw. Health Department credits the new... Now, here's the punchline of this story and the point. The Health Department credits the new uptick in cases from BA... dot, I don't even know what this is called. I've checked out on COVID, so how do you even say this? BA.2? BA2?
I call it BA2.
I didn't even know that was a thing. Honestly, if you'd held a gun to my head and said, what's the new variant, I couldn't have told you. I've totally checked out on it.
That's
BA2.
That's what I call it. I know Walensky was out about it like 2 weeks ago, but obviously overshadowed by Russia-Ukraine.
All right. So the new uptick is BA2 Omicron variant. Okay, but they're still calling it Omicron. That's why. Omicron. Which has infected millions in Europe and has become the dominant strain of COVID-19 in the United States. The health department has been warning that based on what we've seen in Europe, we could see another COVID-19 wave sooner than later. Now, with that in mind, as the city of Philadelphia, and I am sure other large metropolitan cities run by Democrats are threatening the same thing, with that in mind, what sense does it make to lift Title 42? A border policy that has led to the expulsion of a vast majority of people trying to file asylum claims in the United States. So three states sue over this yesterday, Missouri, Arizona, Louisiana, three Republican-governed states announcing they're suing Joe Biden, arguing ending the pandemic-era restriction would result in an unprecedented crisis at the United States southern border. Now, we know the stupid old man wants a crisis at the border. We know they want the free flow of millions of people to cross our borders as fast as they can on purpose. We know this. But as city officials in Philadelphia and other major cities start to threaten you with your freedoms again, that maybe masking, maybe lockdowns, maybe paperwork to verify you've had your shots again, the GOP has yet to really connect these two, and I'm not sure why. This year, it seems to me, and this is one of these things I'm eager to talk with Dr. Oz about, if I'm running for Senate, this is one of the stories I tell. If cities like Philadelphia are going to continue to ask you to mask up and lock down and show papers, and by the way, they're not done with you. I mean, let's just be clear. We're in the all clear phase. But Dr. Bedigal hopes you have a stash of masks around. They're not done with you. They'll come. Omicron will return, and it's going to get very concerning out there. And so the smartest, safest thing you can do is mask up.
Again, it depends on utilizing a lockdown in a positive way, as opposed to just thinking you're going to hide from the virus forever.
Yeah. Dr. Fauci. Title 42, a crucial tool for controlling the influx of illegal aliens at our southern border, said Missouri's Attorney General Eric Schmidt. Now, I personally, if it's me, nobody asked me, and Schmidt's fantastic, I agree. But if it were me, I would simply mention, listen, we're not out of the woods yet on Omicron. It's very clear. Health officials around the country are saying they're on the lookout for a spike in cases. As such, Title 42 makes good sense to control the pandemic. Why don't you play to the panic porn for a minute on this? If you want to win on Title 42 and bring some other people who are recalcitrant to your side, and I don't know who that would be, I mean, I can't imagine who the American citizen is who has a problem with making it tougher to break into the country. I have not met him or her, but I don't know. If they exist, I suppose they're the same people that are terrified of COVID. I would guess they're one and the same. They're the people with the feels. They're the ones that talk about the Statue of Liberty. Usually, when you talk about people breaking into the country, they always bring up the Statue of Liberty and give me your tired and your poor and your huddled masses yearning to breathe free and all that rot. They just want a chance. They're just human beings. They're not animals. Those same idiots. I think they're the same people that are wearing three masks and want you to show papers to go to a concert. So it seems to me that what you say about Title 42 is, you know, I'm with you. Huddled masses yearning to breathe free and everything, blah, blah, blah. But what about COVID? How do you think these people justify those two conflicting issues in their mind? Do you have you met a liberal and asked them, how do you fear COVID the way you do and maintain your support for wide open borders? How do you walk and chew gum on those two at the same time? Ask your favorite liberal if they can explain that one for you, because I have yet to hear it cogently explained for me.
No, same experience. The problem is they just dismiss it. They're just like, oh, you're just trying to stoke fear. You know, that's that Republican anti-immigration talk.
Yeah. Never answering directly, what then do we do about COVID? If you're serious about trying to curtail COVID and contain it, what sense does it make to continue to bring people in by the millions without proper health screenings and just flying them all over the country? How does that help contain COVID? Are you serious about I'm serious. Like, at its zenith, what is the bigger threat to these, you know, pro-mask, pro-panic porn COVID people? Is it open borders? Well, I guess they don't think that's a threat. So I guess maybe I've answered my own question. They think COVID's the bigger threat. But why do they not make the correlation that millions of people breaking into the country are carrying it? Where's the disconnect? Well, that's liberalism. They don't have to be accountable. They don't have to be intellectually consistent or honest. They just get to have the feels about any one subject, scream and hiss and yell about it. And then when you try to put two of them together at the same time, it's like, you know, their tribal politics when they start to war with each other. That's why gays can't stand the trans thing. And nobody will talk about it, but it's just true. Gays can't stand the trans movement. Title 42, crucial tool for controlling the influx of illegal aliens at our southern border. Development comes after the Biden administration announced Friday they will lift Title 42, which is a public health order put in place under the Trump administration. And under that measure, announced at the height of COVID-19, the majority of asylum seekers apprehended at the border expelled immediately back to Mexico or their country of origin without the chance to file asylum claims. The policy is based on recommendations from Rochelle Walensky's CDC, citing the need to protect the country from the further spread of COVID. Now, wouldn't it be interesting to ask Rochelle Walensky what she thinks about Title 42? I'm sure Dr. Fauci wouldn't have anything to say about it if he was asked, because he's not political. Mm-hmm. Friday, the CDC updated their guidance, saying that given the wide availability of tools to combat the virus, it was no longer necessary to block entry of migrants into the country. Oh, isn't that nice how the science has evolved right along with our border policy? It's amazing. Eureka! Scientists in labs have studied that COVID is apparently now manageable when carried by those crossing the southern border illegally. However, in Philadelphia, it's on the rise and very dangerous, and you need to stand ready with a stash of masks. So, if you're following the science at home, and I know this could get tricky, so stay with me here. If you live in and around the city limits of Philadelphia, we're teetering dangerously on the precipice of another huge Omicron wave. Have a stash of masks ready. We're getting very concerned. A 50% spike amongst those of us here domestically. However, the good news is, the science says and the CDC says, as of Friday, people breaking into the country from the south, we have all the tools we need to combat COVID, and don't sweat it. They can come on in and hang out and be fine. Follow?
I think so, yeah.
Following the CDC update, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas announced Title 42 will be rescinded May 23rd, but that expulsions of adults and families will continue until then. Why? Why expel them until then? What's the point? The Biden administration said that delay would give officials time to ready the border with more agents and personnel to facilitate the likely higher number of arrivals. So they know what they're doing, and they're literally saying it aloud. I think it's important to note for any critics in any lawsuits that Title 42 is a public health directive. Okay, that's Jen Psaki's official position yesterday. that suing the White House over Title 42 is silly because it's a public health directive, meaning there's no need for it anymore. The CDC has said we've got all the tools we need to handle people coming in from Guatemala and Ecuador and El Salvador and Colombia. All the tools we need. Don't sweat COVID. We're good. Okay. I just want everybody to remember that that is the official position of the CDC and this White House. This is one of those. This comment is one of those that we need to write down and we need to refer to, and I don't ever want to forget. For the rest of the year, this is now going to be our benchmark. And anytime anyone, every now and again, one of these stories pops up that we're going to have to keep referring back to throughout the course of a year, and this is one of them. For the remainder of 2022, and as we head into the fall elections, we're going to be talking about this until Election Day, Fast Eddie. Just go ahead and tuck this story away and remember it.
Okay.
I'm actually reading this from Al Jazeera. That's the website. Fifth day of April. It's dated. Headline, three states sue Biden administration over ending Title 42 policy. And I don't know, maybe we'll go find Circle Back Girl, Peppermint Patty's comments from the White House press briefing yesterday, which might also be helpful. But I just want everybody to remember this. Write it down. Note it in your planner. Put it in your phone. Whatever you do to make reminders to yourself. And anytime anybody, and I'm talking about any county commissioner, any school district superintendent, any school board, any mayor, anytime you ever hear anyone say, oh boy, look out, COVID cases on the rise. Hope you have a stash of masks ready. Omicron's on the march. There's an uptick. We've seen it in Europe, and now it's coming. Ooh, better get. All you have to say is, you know, it's funny. We did away with Title 42 at the border. And they will say, well, what has that got to do with this? Well, let me remind you. When the Biden administration rescinded Title 42, which lifted restrictions, COVID restrictions on people coming across the border, and three attorneys general sued over that issue, the White House official position was, quote, I think it's important to note for any critics in any lawsuits that Title 42 is a public health directive. Meaning, this is not an issue. It is not necessary. The CDC, Friday, remember this, you got to remember, folks, this is the trick in combating these people because they're going to forget that they told you COVID is over. And they're going to try to bring COVID back and tell you, Bettigol here at the health department in Philadelphia is already starting to ratchet it back up again. Hope you have a stash of masks ready. 50% more COVID now. If I were a member in good standing of the Philadelphia media that could have access to the Kenney administration, I would say, excuse me, Ms. Bettigol, you're talking about a rise and uptick in COVID and that we better have a stash of masks ready. What then do you say about the CDC on Friday saying we don't need Title 42 at the border anymore to combat the virus because we have an availability of tools to combat the virus, meaning the virus is no longer a threat, meaning we can have the free flow of illegal aliens across our southern border till our heart's content. The CDC has said we have the tools to combat it. So, said another way, Ms. Bettigol, a family can break into the country from Guatemala today carrying COVID. And the United States policy is we have the tools to deal with them, but I may not be able to have dinner at Butcher and Singer without a mask. Is that your official position? It'd be great if some enterprising member of the media tried to connect these two things. I mean, that's what we do here, but this show is vastly superior to most of the crap media in this town. So I don't expect it, but I'm just saying if someone would like to learn how this is done, I've just put on a clinic. Omicron. That's right. 610-850-0990, the number. 610. Just remember today, remember this day, wherever you live. And I don't care whether you're in a suburb, a major city. I don't care where you live. If you listen to me online, you stream, just remember the CDC And the White House official position is people can come streaming across our southern border all they'd like. We have the tools to deal with COVID. It is no longer a threat. And if the official position is people can come from all over the planet and break into the country illegally and we don't have to sweat them carrying COVID, you sure as hell should be able to go to a concert or your kid's school or out to dinner without being hassled.
It's Dennis Prager on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. You're off to a smart start. Join me today at 1. Now here's Chris DeGaulle.
Now, I mean, between you and me, I was pulling for North Carolina last night. Scrappy. It's a late game, though. Good grief. Why do they start those games so late?
That's what I was trying to watch. My wife was, she's like, has this been like an hour-long pregame? I'm like, yeah.
So late. Tip-off didn't start to what, the 9 o'clock hour or something?
Yeah.
Just, I mean, tip-off. It's like, what are we doing? Why are we, this like Sunday night football, Monday night football doesn't start this late.
They were, Sunday night football's over by like 11 o'clock, give or take. This was like midnight.
I know. I feel it. And it was a nail. Of course, it wasn't a blowout either. It was a nail biter right to the bitter end. It could have gone either way. I mean, it was a great game. North Carolina, KU, and I don't watch college basketball. I don't know anything about college basketball. But the one thing I know about KU, because, by the way, I've heard from some KU friends who have called me out for saying this on the air. But KU, this is not exclusively true of everybody who's a KU fan. But collectively, they're insufferable people. They're like Dallas Cowboys fans. They're just, KU people are just insufferable people. They always have been. As a lifelong Missourian, KU people who are, you know, across the border there in Kansas, I just won't shut their yaps about this damn basketball team. My entire life, ever since I was in elementary school growing up in Missouri, it was KU, KU, Jayhawks, Rock Chalk, Jayhawk, Jayhawk, Jay, all my life. Which is, you know, why when I moved to Philadelphia, I had assumed that there would be, and I don't know why, I assumed that there would be more of a state-by-state rivalry out here. And there just really isn't. It's Philadelphia and everything else, which is remarkable because where I come from, it's Missouri versus Kansas in a, well, literal historical blood feud. And it's never abated since the 1800s. And I mean, there's a disdain between the border states of Missouri and Kansas like you wouldn't believe. Most people don't even know or think about it. Most people don't even know what Missouri is. They just think Kansas is where everything is. Kansas, Kansas City, Kansas. Missouri's not even a thought on most people's minds geographically. So when I moved here, I assumed that there would be great contempt for New Jersey, or New Jersey would have great contempt for Pennsylvanians. Not true. South Jersey basically thinks it's Philadelphia, is what I found.
Right. And with the Big Five, there's even people who say, hey, Villanova is not a Philly school, so you have that contempt toward Villanova from the rest of the Big Five.
Well, that's right, but then, you know, like Rutgers is hanging around in it. Like when Rutgers had a shot to play in, the people around town were like, oh, come on, Rutgers! I was like, come on, Rutgers? Where the hell did that? What? And I've lived here long enough to know Rutgers is not exactly a hometown Philly team.
It's not, but a lot of being the state school of Jersey, that's where a lot of the South Jersey folks go, you know?
Yes, but I mean, when you're, you know, when you're living in Manayunk and you're going, come on, Rutgers! It's like, I'm sorry. I feel like you're stretching a little bit at that point to call it a hometown team,
sure.
Aren't you?
Yeah.
Somebody said on Twitter the other day about Nova. They said if it weren't for the college basketball team there at Villanova, what did they say? They said they'd be Ursinus or Immaculata or something. I can't remember who they were basically insulting Villanova as being completely irrelevant were it not for their basketball program.
Right.
It was some joke going around on Twitter, folks. Don't take it out on me. I'm not mocking Villanova people. But nevertheless, Kansas people just, oof. I secretly last night was kind of hoping for the scrappy North Carolina team that took Duke out to take Kansas out last night, and they didn't ultimately get it done, unfortunately. Came close, but didn't get it done.
No, it was, I mean, they were feeling really good going into the half. It was historic, the win.
Mark Farzetta will be with us today. of the Farzi Show to talk about this couple of moves the Eagles have made as well. Philly's now officially underway now that the threat of a looming baseball strike is over. So we'll check in with him, as we often like to do, just to get a pulse on things sports-wise. We love Farzi. He's actually one of the last guys in Philadelphia sports talk that actually talks about sports and only sports and has not decided to do what I do. I don't know when this phenomenon happened, but speaking of sports talk in Kansas City, there's a host that I know well who was a very well-known and did sports very, very well for a long time. And he still does it. I hadn't checked in with him for years. And just last week, I checked in with him. He has a new logo for his show, which include the whole logo for his show is a mock-up of the Barack Obama campaign poster of 2008, complete with the O swoosh. Remember the Pepsi O? So there was talk that Obama had lifted the O in Pepsi, or the swish logo from Pepsi, right, and put it in his O.
Yeah.
Remember that? So this talk show host, this sports talk show host, has now replicated the Obama imagery and his name, the O in his name. He's made the Obama swoosh.
Ah.
So went from a show that never, ever talked politics. I don't know. COVID, folks, broke a lot of people. COVID absolutely pushed this country over the cliff. And people who were left-leaning and Democrat voting but kept that to themselves, I don't know what COVID did, but it broke these people, and they felt emboldened to go full tilt, full time into politics. And while, you know, sports talk here in Philadelphia has always been left-leaning, and they've always favored Democrats, same here. COVID became a team sport, and if you weren't on team COVID, you were trash, and they adopted it like a religion, almost like a hometown sports team. And they felt free to just, and frankly, I'm sorry to say, there were a lot of corporate ownerships in radio that felt the same way. So they felt they were just cheering not only the cause, but they were doing their bosses proud. So they fully embraced it. And I got to tell you, sports talk may as well be what we do with a little sports thrown in for good measure. I haven't listened to it. I don't listen to it. But every now and again when I check in, I am stunned that they're basically doing what we do now.
It's honestly very rough to listen to. And just a funny story. I mean, obviously, Mike Missanelli went all in on the COVID thing. So,
right.
So he tweeted last year about Aaron Nola putting the entire team in danger. So I quote tweeted at him, and I'm just like, listen, Mike, I said, stick to sports. Like, leave this kind of talk to the big boys like Chris. And he blocked me. And then he insulted me, but I couldn't see it because he blocked me.
Yeah, that's his play. Yeah, he's blocked. I've also been blocked. He's very, very tough. So, yeah, Mark is one of the last guys. And truly, if you actually want a guy who talks about sports, doesn't give a rip really about politics. I mean, he has his positions, but he's not inclined to share them and doesn't feel like he has any place to share them. He just likes sports a lot. And so he wants to talk about sports. If that's like a nice, refreshing reprieve and you think, well, that sounds great, you ought to listen to the Farzi Show, because that's what he does. And that's why we lean on him. There's maybe one other guy in town. Ray Didinger is about the only other guy, I think, in all of Philadelphia, and I'm serious. Ray and Mark are probably the only two people that I know of in all of Philadelphia that do not talk about anything but the sports that they love.
Yeah.
Like, not that they don't have political opinions, not that they don't follow the news, but they do not discuss it on their shows. And the American left is so broken. COVID made them such cultists. They can't help it. So anyway, sit tight for that. 610-850-0990, the number. 610-850-0990. Just a little more on Title 42. It turns out there are two United States senators already speaking up, sounding off with concern, and they're Democrats. Mark Kelly, the astronaut, husband of Gabby Giffords. Remember him? And Kyrsten Sinema, she's back. They want to know if Joe Biden has lost his ever-loving mind, Karen Townsend writes at Hot Air. The Biden border crisis in full swing, rapidly growing worse. So what does the president do? He finally caves to the progressive wing of the Democrat Party and thinks announcing that Title 42 will end May 23rd and that that's a good idea. And as an added bonus, Biden promises COVID shots will be the illegal migrants, promises they'll have the shots there for illegal migrants crossing the border. What could possibly go wrong? So they claim they're going to administer the shot at the border as they break in.
Yeah.
So Border Patrol agents with their whips on horseback will will detain the migrants and stick them with the syringe. Some moderate Democrats pushing back, not mincing their words of disapproval. Senator Sinema said that the decision by CDC announced on Friday shows Biden has shown a lack of understanding about the crisis at our border. And she's not wrong. Biden hasn't a clue. And that's because not only has he been in denial since he took office and did away with the successful policies and agreements in use at the border during the previous administration, he's never bothered to so much as take a day trip to the southern border. He's gotten a firsthand look. He has not had a firsthand look at the U.S. border with Mexico, except one time in 2008 when he sped by in an SUV and was at a small portion of the border for about 5 minutes. That claim should be taken with a grain of salt, as Mumbling Joe is known to make up stories. Anyway, that was in El Paso, hundreds of miles from the Del Rio sector of Texas. Even the border of New Mexico is feeling the effects of Biden's border crisis. Senator Mark Kelly agrees with his colleague from Arizona. Biden's move is unacceptable. Biden announced his decision earlier this last week and now has the blessing of the CDC. Joe Manchin, not happy either. Let's do something to reform immigration law loopholes and actually secure the southern border using laws currently in place before we end one of the tools that mitigate the flood of illegal migrants. Is it too much to ask some common sense be put into action once in a while? If we can't handle humanitarian crisis at the border now, why does Biden think that we'll be able to when the caravans begin again? Well, they've already started. Biden's announcement of a specific date has given them a go-ahead to start their trip through Mexico all the way to the border. Thanks, Joe. Again, I say I don't think framing Title 42 as a border control or a migration control measure is the smart play. I think you have to frame this as it was designed, as a pandemic control metric. Why wouldn't you? See, politically, Republicans shouldn't screw this up and leave it to them to make this about border enforcement. It's not. Play the hits. If people want to talk and sell the panic porn of COVID, then you tell the American public you're fighting to keep Title 42 in place because we hang like a loose tooth precariously, teetering on the edge of maybe falling back into COVID restrictions, lockdowns, and masks, and we don't want that again. And the only responsible thing to do is to make sure, now that we've all been properly vaccinated here across the country, and that we... Now, folks, I'm talking like a politician for a minute, all right? Let me pretend I'm candidate Stigall. The thing to say is, Title 42 must remain in place because we've come too far in our fight with COVID. We've been able to open our businesses and get our kids back to school. We've been able to take the masks off. Everyone who wants access to the shot has had it. So we're now a country with the tools to combat COVID. It would be a shame to have to take a step back and see the spread of COVID increase. And one of the fastest ways that could happen is to allow millions of people to cross our border illegally from far-flung countries not being screened for public health good. That's why Title 42 is so important. It is a public health measure. That's what you say. Border enforcement is an issue. It's wildly popular. It has Americans' approval, but it's not working as an emotional issue. So turn it on its head. Force leftists, force the media to explain why they don't support controlling COVID. I'm serious. That's the way you say it. The next time somebody brings up the border, say, why don't you support controlling COVID? Here's the worst case in that exchange. Your leftist friend has to admit COVID's not a thing anymore. The best part is they get flummoxed and can't explain it because they live in terror of COVID and they admit that you got better of them in the conversation when they have to acknowledge allowing millions of people in from the South without screening them for public health reasons is threatening to their health behind their three masks and all their shots and their boosters. I don't know. To me, it just seems like a no-brainer, this Title 42 issue. Play the hits. Go with COVID. Scare the hell out of people who are easily scared. If that's the way you have to sell it, then do it that way. 610-850-0990 as we take a quick break here. Dr. Oz on the way today. Andy McCarthy on the way. Mark Farzetta, Steve Moore. It is a chock-a-block Tuesday. You know, last August, our friend Miranda Devine wrote at the New York Post, it's Democrats and Biden's administration's border policies that are spreading COVID. She wrote this last August. Cheery Dr. Anthony Fauci was on television again, warning us things are going to get worse with COVID. She wrote this August 1st of 2021, Miranda Devine at the New York Post. It's the Delta variant of the virus that's to blame for putting us back in masks, the nation's top infectious disease expert told Jonathan Karl on ABC. Fauci didn't mention all the other Greek letters of the alphabet lining up to do us harm. There's always something, like the Lambda variant, which apparently comes from, guess where, South America. This one is said to be worse than all the other letters. So why the hell is the southern border wide open in the middle of a pandemic? Wrote Miranda back in August of last year. If you're a law-abiding American citizen arriving at an American airport, even if you're fully vaccinated, you have to produce a negative COVID test from the past 1 to 3 days or you won't be allowed in. But at the southern border, you can wander across coughing and sneezing and they'll give you a welcome packet and send you on your way to spread the disease. It's a smart column. It was very well written back on August 1st.
Miranda this Devine. Is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Hi there, Chris. You are better every day and starting from a very high standard. You are just on fire every day.
Hey, Chris, thank you so much for everything you do for us to keep us informed.
Good morning, Chris. Love your show, pal.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
A number of Democrats complained that there were hard questions asked. Well, that's our responsibility. Every one of the questions focused on her record. Her record as a judge, her sentencing record, her academic writings, her speeches to law schools. Not a single Republican senator asked her about her high school yearbook, engaged in the kind of personal slanders that Democrats have made a business about. If the questions were hard, it is because her record is at the extreme.
Ted Cruz.
There have been 115 men and women who have served on the Supreme Court. If Judge Jackson is confirmed, I believe she will prove to be the most extreme and the furthest left justice ever to serve on the United States Supreme Court.
Could have driven a dump truck through those pauses, Ted Cruz. Wow, those were dramatic. Ted Cruz, Texas Senator, whoosh, with the pregnant pause of all that's a 9-month pregnant pause from Ted Cruz there. Andrew C. McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, Fox News contributor. He's been watching these proceedings. He joins us. It sounds like three Republicans signing off on confirming her. They are Murkowski of Alaska, Collins of Maine, Romney of Utah. Andy, good morning.
Morning, Chris.
So, not that this is a surprise. Nobody thought that she wouldn't be confirmed. And I think, actually, the last time you and I talked, you had pretty much concluded that there would be some Republicans that would peel off. Did you anticipate there'd be more than just those three that we kind of banked on?
I think I told you between 3 and 6, and I actually thought, especially after the first day of her hearing, I thought it would probably be on the 6 side, but I'm not at all surprised. I guess the surprise is Graham, who usually votes for the nominees, because I've always thought that Graham was on the, he's on a 1970s track of how you evaluate Supreme Court justices, which leaves out judicial philosophy, which to me is the most important thing, and talks about, what their professional qualifications and ethical background is. But I think since Kavanaugh, Graham did a very good job at and took kind of a star turn at, he's changed his mind about Supreme Court nominations. So three is about right. That's in terms of what we predicted. Yeah.
I value your brain on these things. So rather than even focus on Jackson here, I think generally you bring up something interesting because you're a scholar and you know the Constitution like the back of your hand, and you studied our nation's founding. What do you think that our founders, were you to guess? I know it's always dangerous to try to guess what our founders might say or think. If you could resurrect them and put them in front of Fox News and watch these confirmation hearings and the debate discussing how we confirm these people for Supreme Court, what do you think they'd say?
Well, first, they'd be surprised at what I guess the thing that you can't predict how they would feel about is how the media has changed judicial confirmations. Washington nominated a Supreme Court justice, and the guy started the next day.
There was no Fox News then. No,
there was no Fox News then. And one time, President Andrew Jackson, some federal judge issued a writ of habeas corpus when Jackson was a general and had New Orleans under martial law. And they tried to execute the writ of habeas corpus to get him to release somebody who he had arrested under martial law. And General Jackson had his troops march the judge out of the city limits. So, things are a little different, Chris, than they have been at previous times in our history. So I think, that's the wild card here. These have really become media extravaganzas in a way that they never were before. And the other thing that I think the framers, and I think we can be confident how they feel about this, they would think it's a disaster that the courts do politics. I mean, let's focus on the media is one thing, but let's focus on the reason why these hearings are the way they are, particularly when it's a Democratic nominee. But, this nominee had to answer a lot of very aggressive questioning as well. The reason we've disintegrated into this is that the court does politics. It doesn't regard left-wing justices, progressive justices, do not regard the Constitution as written as binding. They reserve the right to grow it. And the framers would point out that, number one, the federal government's supposed to be limited. Number two, the most limited part of it is supposed to be the judiciary, because they don't answer to the people. The framers' whole theory of governance is the Constitution is a document for the governance of a free people, where through their elected representatives, they choose how to live, with some minor exceptions for our basic rights. And there was no thought when the framers, ratified wrote the Constitution, which was then ratified by the states. There was no thought that the federal judiciary could rule that an act of Congress was unconstitutional. That was something that would be handled at the ballot box, because the public would be dedicated to the Constitution as written. So they have had a very different idea of our governance than what we see today. And I think, to Ted Cruz's point, they would object to judges whose record demonstrates that they reserve the right to ignore the written law and evolve it under the guise of the Constitution.
There was a survey that was floating around, and Cruz actually tweeted it out. Her answer to Judge Jackson's answer to natural rights, and I'm paraphrasing here because I don't have it in front of me, but I was kind of struck, and the reason I'm asking you to kind of explain historically the way the founders might think about this is, our Declaration of Independence, for heaven's sakes, our founding documents, this notion of natural rights conferred on us by God, you know, things that cannot be taken from us, gifts from God, literally cannot be taken. And what she thought of that, and she said she couldn't, I forget the words she used exactly or what the words were, but it basically didn't really acknowledge it. Didn't say she quibbled with it, but didn't necessarily acknowledge it as a foundational principle. And to me, if you don't even acknowledge natural rights, and I assume, I don't know, how many of these justices have actually been asked that? Sotomayor, Kagan, I don't know. If you don't acknowledge natural rights, Andy, we're in a scary place, it seems to me, as a Supreme Court justice.
Not only that, Chris, it's a very interesting area of the law and of constitutional theory, which divides people on the right. Because, as we know, the Constitution in the Bill of Rights acknowledges the existence of unenumerated rights, right? The rights that are not written in the Constitution. And there's a great debate on the right about whether conservative justices ought to enforce unenumerated, unwritten rights. Rights like, for example, freedom of the press is a right that's enumerated, right? It's written into the document, but the document acknowledges that there are unenumerated rights. So should conservative judges get activists and, for example, find a right to exist to protect unborn life, even though that's not written into the Constitution? That's something that divides people on the right. It was the subject of great debates when Robert Bork would debate Hadley Arkes, who was a great natural rights theorist. And it's a really interesting area. So you wish that she had kind of expounded more on that, just because it'd be interesting to know what she thinks about all that. I suspect that there are people like myself who think that the fact that we have unenumerated rights does not mean that the courts are able to, erect and enforce them as if they were written into the Constitution. I imagine that she would probably side with the people on the right who say, yes, that's an open door for judges to get activists. And I think what people on the right are always concerned about is if you endorse on our side that courts can make it up as they go along, that gives progressive justices an open door to, from the bench enact all the progressive pieties that they would like to see enforced with the might of the Constitution. So it would have been a very interesting discussion, unfortunately we didn't have it.
Just at the risk of, getting too philosophical here, it's conceptually, isn't it something that every American, whether you're hardcore left-wing progressive or super, super, super conservative, shouldn't all of us agree that there are certain things that are absolutely granted to us as rights that no human being holding any office can take? I mean, if you don't believe that, then anything is up for debate, and that's a scary place. So I suppose maybe there's some progressives who, I remember, Rush would often talk about Obama's obsession with this notion of the Constitution being a charter of negative liberties, right? Maybe you can expound on that a little bit. Which is a document basically saying what government can't do. That leftists are always stymied and frustrated that we have a document that says government can't do the following things to the people. That always makes the left mad.
Right.
So does that go hand in glove with the notion of there are certain rights that can't be taken?
Yeah, I think they're two sides of the same coin. And philosophically, Chris, the way I think to think about this is there are certain legal codes that are, what they regard as positive law. And that's a kind of a deceptive term, because positive in this sense doesn't mean good. It means concrete, something written that you can see. Not something that's not nebulous out there, drifting in the beyond like a penumbra. And our theory of government is that the public, the people, can do whatever they choose to do as long as there's not a law against it. The other philosophy of governance, this positive philosophy of governance, is that you can do whatever the government says you can do, which is a very different presumption. And I think what progressives would like to get to and what they're trying to move us toward gradually is with all their regulations and, you know, all the stifling little laws that they make on this, that, and the other things that would be shocking to the framers if these things are actually regulated. What they're trying to do is get us all to a place where what you're allowed to do is what the government says you're allowed to do, whereas the whole point of our government is to limit the government so that we can do what we want and the government has very little say in telling us what not to do. And where Obama was coming from is this idea that the Bill of Rights is a the Constitution is a charter of negative rights. What he means by that, or what is meant by that, is that it tells the government what the government can't do so that we can have liberty. Mm-hmm. And it would be anathema to the framers to turn it into what government must do for you, because government can't do for you without taking away from me. And that was not the idea that the framers had. Where the framers' idea was that where the government says, where the Constitution says, for example, you have freedom of speech, that was a freedom that's enjoyed by everybody. It's not a freedom that's enjoyed by A at the expense of B. And what the left would like to do is turn our system into a redistributive system in which the government is basically the overseer to ensure fairness by taking what the government decides is the too much that some people have and distributing it to the others who don't have enough. And of course, there's no having a system like that without it being fraught with politics and having the redistribution done not on the basis of fairness, but on who the insiders and the connected people are versus the outsiders.
So then if you were to hook them up to a lie detector test, Judge Jackson is probably closer to being honest here when, you know, she says she can't or won't answer the question about natural rights. Progressives may well not either believe in it or they acknowledge that the founders, you know, structured a government that way, but they don't like it. It works across purposes for them, the idea that we are gifted divinely gifted rights that cannot be taken, no matter what. Progressives don't like that concept.
I think they don't, but I think, Chris, that they would use it. See, my theory about the left is not really a Nietzsche theory, I guess. It's like a power politics theory. But I think they decide what they want, and then they reason backwards. And if natural rights would help them get there, there'd be, you know, for that 5 minutes, they would be all for natural rights. And then in the next case, if they needed to be strict constructionists, they'd be strict constructionists. In the next case, you know, they figure out what they want first, and then they use whatever legal theory is ready at hand and argue it passionately as if they really believed it. But what they believe in is the outcome.
I know you've got to run. I assume that this is the last time, barring anybody gets ill or, you know, God forbid anybody passes away, this will be the last time we talk about a confirmation hearing for a while for the Supreme Court.
I guess we have to say I sure hope so, because, you know, we don't wish anyone bad health, obviously. I'd be very surprised if Biden gets another one. I think the oldest one on the court once Breyer is gone will be Justice Thomas, who's only about, he's 73, 74, and he's a vigorous guy. I know he was a little under the weather a couple of weeks ago, but I hear that he's fine, and he's a great justice, and we should hope he's on there for another 20 years.
Yeah, I don't, I can't take many more of these for a while. I'm ready for a break, quite frankly. And incidentally,
why can't we have a war or something?
That's right. Yeah, there's a little thing going on over there. And congratulations on, for the first time ever in my show's history, using the word penumbra in a conversation. That is a high watermark for me, Andy. Thank you.
Hey man, if we're gonna talk about the Supreme Court, we have to talk about penumbras, right? That's where the law is, man.
So she'll be confirmed Friday, yes?
I think they have a problem with one senator. I think if she has enough votes, she may be confirmed. But none of this matters, Chris, because Breyer's going to finish out the term, which won't end until the end of June.
Oh, okay. All right. Andrew C. McCarthy, he'll be on Fox News analyzing this and always over there at National Review. Great to talk to you, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Have a good one.
more of Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
There is something so satisfying about the home opener. It just, it feels like you've officially turned a corner. Even if it's chilly, even if the weather conditions aren't ideal, there's something psychological about Philly's home opener. Love it. Haven't missed it in years. Yeah, the only thing, the last 2 years since COVID that I have regretted, that I've missed terribly, the official start to spring in my mind is going down to Clearwater and watching the Phillies in spring training. And unfortunately, COVID has precluded us from doing that for the last couple of years. And then we had some weird, I don't really even know, to be honest with you, and this is why we bring in Farzi. Mark Farzetta, host of the Farzi Show, which you can watch live on YouTube. You can stream it later on Twitch, Apple, Spotify, FarziShow.com. He's also over there on Fox 29 as a sports contributor. I don't quite understand, Farzi, what happened with Major League Baseball this year. I know there was a period of time there where we were talking about maybe them not playing. I guess players were holding out for more money or whatever. But how did that eat into spring training? Good morning. Welcome in.
Good morning, and thank you. Great to be on with you again, my friend.
Yeah.
And I couldn't agree more. When baseball season starts, that's the change of the season, the change of the year, as far as I'm concerned. But, yeah, it started out, I know a lot of people, when they look at work stoppages in sports, they tend to look at players. For me, this was more about the owners. This was a lockout. It wasn't a strike. Okay. But this was more about the owners trying to get what they could. And they flexed their muscles at 0 hour, so to speak, and they didn't agree to the players' terms. Players, of course, didn't agree to their terms. But ultimately the owners, with all the money, could say simply, all right, well, we're not playing, which means you guys aren't making money either. Let's see who lasts longer. And, of course, that one's going to go to the owners. But they did make some good compromises. They did make some good rule changes. Things that will be implemented next year as well. But one of the things that's going into effect right now is a designated hitter in baseball, and in both leagues. And I actually like what the players did. They did something that has been a problem in Major League Baseball for a long time, which is player service time. A guy like Chris Bryan is a normal name to be brought up, who was delayed maybe 2 days of starting out the season. So didn't start out with the big league club with the Cubs some years ago, so the Cubs could save money. Smart business move, but kind of a shrewd move as well, because they didn't want to start the clock on a service time earlier than they had to. So they spread some money out for the younger players to make more money earlier, which is good. But a lot of this, I think, came down to the owners, and it's a big mistake by Major League Baseball, because I feel like many, many times, including even before this lockout, during the pandemic, they had all the health issues supposedly worked out, and then it took months for them to work out the financials of how it was going to work in a shortened season. I think baseball has done a horrible job of reminding their fan base, which, by the way, has dwindled. The World Series ratings have gone down year after year after year over the last 20 years, and it's just awful. But baseball has done a horrible job of continuously reminding their fans that they're a business first and a sport second. But bottom line, I'm glad they're back. I'm glad the Phillies are stacked, and I'm glad they're going to make a run, hopefully, at the division this year.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Is baseball, I mean, I don't know how else to say it. I hate to say it. Is it dying as a sport? Because the criticism I always hear from people who talk about baseball is how slow it moves and how it hasn't kept up with kind of the short attention span of the American public. And some purists say, good, it shouldn't. And others say baseball really needs to figure out a way to speed up. Where do you come down on that?
Yeah, I come down like this. Baseball is a taxi cab in a world of Uber and Lyft. there's better options. And there's better ways to serve that sports gene. Now, look, I want to tell you, Chris, I don't know if we've had this conversation before, but I was a baseball-first guy. Baseball was the sport we talked about at the dinner table. Baseball was the sport my dad would always tell me about he was playing when he was growing up in Ambler. And it was a sport I loved my whole life. But because they have continuously reminded you, hey, fans, screw you. We're a business. We're going to take care of this as many times as possible. You sit there and wait. Well, baseball hasn't become the sport that is worth waiting for anymore. Baseball still thinks it's 1952, and the NFL isn't really in full swing yet to what it is today. Baseball needs to realize that the game does need major changes. Now, a designated hitter is not going to make the game any faster, but it'll make the game more exciting. I look at baseball and I think of things like, I think they need an efficiency expert to come in and just hack away time that's just wasted throughout the sport. So I think that's one thing that they have to do. I used to appreciate and really like the fact that baseball was slow, but now it's become like, I know people always joked about this before, but now it's become molasses. It's the slowest possible form of the four major sports that we have. And in a day, like, people talk about my generation with our minds being shrunk because of MTV and our attention span shrinking. Now we have the phone where we scroll Twitter. We just keep going, looking for the next thing that's going to catch our eye. In that world now, baseball can't continue to exist in the form that it has. They need bigger changes. They need to look at how they can improve the sport. They need to make sure that they can swipe through it and get rid of any dead time that is in that game. It is unfortunate. I love the way the game's played, or at least I used to. Now it's all about analytics. It's overthinking, and that overthinking is making the game take longer with pitching changes. And you don't go to a ballpark anymore because of a guy starting. You go to a ballpark now because maybe you'll have a lineup that will mash like the Phillies should this year. But I miss the days of Roy Halladay, Cliff Lee, Nolan Ryan, even to go before then. Guys that you knew were going to get the ball and go 7, 8, maybe even 9 innings in a game. That, to me, is not nearly as exciting. Or what you watch today is not nearly as exciting as you did even with a slower-paced game from even 10 years ago.
Well, there's some Phillies that I love and I love to watch, but I have to say that this season, for instance, the thing that excites me most is hearing Manco and Manco's available at the park now. Like, that's, you know, when I'm more excited about, you know, what Airmark's offering, that's probably not good.
Yeah, Nick Castellanos, Kyle Schwarber, Manco and Manco, those are the big acquisitions that the Phillies needed this season to get people back in baseball. Yeah.
No, in all sincerity, though, just briefly, and we'll move on. What do you make of their roster this season? You like their like how they're stacked?
Well, let me just say this, Chris. I just hope that Kyle Schwarber and Nick Castellanos and whoever's patrolling left field realizes the hollow ground, because that was Chris DeGaulle's spot for PAL softball every year. So I just hope when they go out there, they take a moment and they realize that that's where Chris DeGaulle played.
I caught a few critical when it counted.
I mean, Chris, we still talk about, me and the other PAL softball team members, we all visit your plaque. and we just take a moment there and just, what, Chris DeGaulle, what a guy, what a great field. But no, you know, seriously, yeah, and yes, you did. Can confirm, hell of an athlete, Chris DeGaulle. but when it comes to this lineup, I am stoked. It comes to Kyle Schwarber, Nick Castellanos. Nick Castellanos, a guy I've followed his whole career. When the Phillies were bringing up Mike Helfranco, the Tigers were grooming Nick Castellanos. And I remember thinking, if Franco could be Castellanos, the Phillies can be set. That never happened with Mike Helfranco, unfortunately. But Castellanos' career continued to bloom. Kyle Schwarber is the old-term professional hitter. He's not your prototypical leadoff guy, and he has talked about his mindset going into that leadoff spot. He just has to look at it as, hey, just get a good at bat. And that's what a guy who can hit third, fourth, or fifth in a lineup should be thinking if he is put into that leadoff spot. I think you're going to have some young, infused energy in this lineup with a guy like Bryson Stott, hopefully manning that hot corner at third base. I think Mickey Moniak is finally going to come into his own. And I don't know if he's going to jump off the stat sheet at people as a number one overall pick should, but I think he is going to turn some heads and make a lot of people think, man, I probably used that bust term a little too early for a guy that the Phillies drafted when he was 16 years old. So I love what he is. I actually interviewed him a couple of years ago and was very impressed with how he has matured physically, also things he was saying about his work ethic, his approach to the game, his approach to the plate. Kevin Long, the Phillies' new hitting coach, has worked wonders with him so far in the spring, and it looks like that's something he'll be able to bring north with him. But as far as the lineup goes, this is the best Phillies lineup that we have seen since the heyday of Ryan Howard and Chase Utley. And that heyday, you know, was 12, 13 years ago already. I mean, wow. Everyone talks about the 10 years between seasons of making the playoffs. Well, you're talking about the years of Ryan Howard hitting 40 home runs and driving in 130 RBIs and Chase Elliott hitting 30 home runs. You're talking about 2009 is the last time you saw a lineup hit like that. So this lineup
you believe this lineup is the 2008, 9, 10 Philadelphia Phillies?
I think that this lineup could be better than that Phillies lineup.
By the way, not for nothing, I know you, just ticking off that list, I noticed you did not mention the multi-million dollar man, Bryce Harper. He does not jump to the top of your mind anymore?
Well, it's like we take him for granted already, NL MVP, blah, blah, blah. No, but in all seriousness, he's a guy that you look at in this lineup, your reigning NL MVP, and joining forces with him are two guys that can combine for 70 home runs this year. Rhys Hoskins, who hopefully has his power stroke back. He was definitely more aggressive at the plate last year. It might have ended up hurting him with the injury that he had that made him miss the last month of the season. But one thing happened last year, and I'm glad you brought up Bryce Harper, but in terms of the lineup, Schwarber, Castellanos, Harper, Realmuto, Hoskins, Segura, he needs to return to some old form and hopefully get some pop from somebody else in the infield. But and Didi Gregorius can still hit the long ball. Not so much last year, but he can. I think that part of his game is not gone. I think he had an injury-plagued season last year. But when you think about Harper, one thing that I'm really looking forward to seeing, with Hoskins being out at the end of the year, and this might sound odd to some people, but Hoskins is a guy that's obviously a career Philly, came up with this organization, came up with a lot of guys on the roster. So I think a lot of people looked at him as this was his team. I think last year, throughout the first month and a half of the season when Hoskins was out, I feel like there was an official changing of the guard in the clubhouse where this became Bryce Harper's team. You might look at it and say, well, he's a $330 million man. Of course, it's his team. When you go into somebody else's backyard, it's still their backyard, even if you're maybe the best player, right? With Hoskins being out, I think it was a very similar thing, but not identical to, but similar to, when Pat Gillick traded Bobby Abreu away, and this became Jimmy Rollins, Chase Utley, Ryan Howard's Philadelphia Phillies, Cole Hamels' Philadelphia Phillies team. I think in a lesser way, something similar happened when Hoskins went out with injury last year, Harper went on the tear, and had this team six games out of the division by the time the year ended, and a couple of games out of a wild card spot. So that is something that I really look forward to seeing this year, this officially becoming Bryce Harper's team, and seeing him lead on the field and in the clubhouse as well.
Wow, this is a bold prediction Farzi is making here as home opener kicks off on, Friday. And Mark Farzetta is suggesting that the Philadelphia Phillies team at present is better than our last reigning World Series champion team. So we will see. Now,
The lineup. And you know what? The rotation has potential to do that as well, because that year you had Cole Hamels who was dealing, Jamie Moyer, Brett Myers, and now you have at least Zach Wheeler who came in second in the Cy Young voting, and Aaron Nola needs to bounce back, which is something we've been saying for the last 2 years. But yes, your lineup definitely has potential to be better than what you saw in 08.
Something I noticed watching some of the March Madness stuff. I'm not a college basketball guy, but one thing I did notice was during some of the commercial breaks, I couldn't help but notice our own Joel Embiid is now featured prominently in some Coca-Cola spots. Now, that's notable to me because, one, he's hilarious, and, you know, I get his star power. He's not, how do I say this? I would imagine they had to work with him a little bit, coach with him a little bit. I mean, English not his first language, right? So it was interesting to me that he's a choice now as a pitch man. I had not noticed that until this season. Am I onto something there or no?
He's been around. Hulu have been using him for a part of their campaign. I know he's done some other things as well, but I know he does.
That's got to be the highest profile product anyway, maybe?
Yeah. No,
Coke?
In terms of what? Oh, yeah, no, that's probably his you're probably right. That is probably his highest profile. But I think he's great. I think he's very personable. I mean, this is a guy, and it's funny he's talking about English being not his first language. I don't even know if it's his third language. I think the guy speaks about four or five different languages.
No, he's brilliant.
This is a guy that when he was at Kansas, supposedly would tell that when he was 6 years old, growing up in Cameroon, his rite of passage was he had to kill a lion. And people believed him. So that's charisma. That's personality. That's salesmanship, if nothing else.
He's hilarious.
Else.
Yeah.
He is. He's got a big personality. And since he has become a father, I think his son Arthur is now two, but since he became a father, he's kind of dialed back his social media presence.
Yeah.
But I think this guy could do the famous, you know, sell a ketchup popsicle to a woman in white gloves I think he's got that much of a personality.
Is he one of the biggest stars now in the NBA? I don't have a sense of it. I mean, is he like one of those Mount Rushmore names in all of basketball now?
I think over the last 2 years he has been. That is shown, I think, in Sixers ratings, and I think that is shown in league MVP voting. I think Embiid is going to finish second in the MVP voting. If it was my call, Joel Embiid's the MVP. I think he's the most valuable player. What he's had to overcome this year with the Ben Simmons drama throughout the vast majority of the season, he has played at the highest level. I think he's kept the Sixers in it throughout the year, not just in it, but a top four team throughout the year. That's all Joel Embiid. There's nothing more valuable than that. I think it's going to eventually go to Nikola Jokic for the second time in a row. Giannis Antetokounmpo has entered his name in that category as well. But I think marketability, I think Mount Rushmore names in the NBA right now with personality and talent, I think Joel Embiid's up there, no doubt.
So this tournament comes down to the Final Four, Villanova, and it didn't – not a great outcome for Villanova, obviously, versus Kansas. But Jay Wright is one of those guys. It's hard not to like him.
Absolutely. I mean, look, I'm a Temple guy through and through, man. But when I graduated from Temple, I became a lot more familiar with the respect around the city that Big Five schools have for one another. And this isn't the day of John Chaney and Raleigh Massimino and both voting to disband the Big Five and all that from years ago. But this is something really special. I think Coaches versus Cancer has really helped that with all the charitable work the Big Five coaches do for that. City Six, when you include Drexel as well. I think that it's something really special that goes on, and it's something that's bigger than basketball. And I think in a city like Philadelphia, you could get away with respecting that more when we have four major sports teams that we're all crazy passionate about. And a lot of people, I mean, look, if Temple had the same run of success that Villanova had, I might be singing a different tune. But I feel like in this city, college sports are something that's really nice to have, something that we do love, but it's nice to have as opposed to something that we get really passionate about, which is professional sports. When you have those four major teams, it kind of takes away from the college scene. When you have five Division I schools, six Division I schools, it kind of dilutes that a little bit in terms of the passion overall for college, because you know you have your Villanova fans, your Temple fans, and throughout. But, Jay Wright is a class act. When I get a chance to talk to his players, they all speak nothing but the highest things about him. Surprisingly, apparently, he loves the fact he doesn't have to wear suits anymore.
This is the first time I've tuned in a bit. When did they ditch the suits? When did that happen? And why?
COVID. They just started going more comfortable for whatever reason. And
I don't care for it. I like seeing Phil Wright's suits. Or Jay Wright's suits, excuse me.
Oh,
I was going to ask you about Phil Martelli, too, by the way. While I'm on this, I was out watching games with a Michigan friend, not from Philadelphia.
Sure.
And he drops out of nowhere. He says, you know, he was bagging on his coach. He didn't like, you know, the punch thrown and the whole thing. He says he's got to go. He goes, I love Phil Martelli. I want him as head coach. I was like, hey, I know that guy. And I don't know anything about basketball, but like I could hang with him because I really like Martelli too.
Yeah, Phil Martelli's great. I absolutely love Phil Martelli. And I thought the whole way Michigan handled that situation was really weird. It's like they didn't expect to make the tournament. They were a bubble team in the last, 2 weeks of the season, I want to say, if not last week of the season, a bubble team. And they made and they said they were suspending their coach, Juwan Howard, for the remainder of the season, which was five games. And then they ended up making the tournament. And they're like, oh, well, that was just for the regular season. He's back now. And I'm like, you cowards. The guy just slapped another man in the face. Like, how accepting are we going to be? And then Chris Rock gets slapped at the Oscars. That's a whole thing. Everybody gets talked about for weeks on end. But,
and then Will Smith said, well, if it's good enough for Michigan, it's good enough for me.
Yeah, he looked at Juwan Howard and was like, you know what? This guy's onto something. Just slap the guy.
All right, Farzi.
It's a wild thing, but yeah.
Before I let you run, the Eagles making some moves as well. You like them?
I think every Eagles fan did what I did yesterday, which was they saw the tweet from Adam Schefter, which is where you know we see a lot of the things initially, and it was a whole bunch of numbers and years and everything, and we went, oh, how we traded away first round picks, that idiot, and then you went back to your phone and you went, hold on a second. They still have two first-round picks this year and two first-round picks next year and another second-round pick? man, Howie won another trade. Now it's a matter of doing the thing that we're more worried about, because Howie has been good at trades. This is a very good trade for the Eagles. Eagles fans will now root really hard for any team that's playing against the Saints next year. I think one of the biggest conundrums is, I don't know the schedule yet, but if the Saints play the Cowboys, oh my God, good luck, Philadelphia, in choosing who you're rooting for. But you want the Saints to do bad because the Eagles now have their first-round pick. So the worse they are, the better the pick for the Eagles next year. It's very similar to following the Colts and what they were doing with Carson Wentz with the compensatory pick that the Eagles got, conditional pick that the Eagles got in return for Wentz that eventually turned into a first-rounder. This is a good move by the Eagles, a smart move by Howie Roseman. He hedges his bets, essentially, on Jalen Hurts. And this is something I thought he would do. This is something I predicted that he would do. He would flip a first-round pick to next year. That's what he did. So now he's got two firsts next year. So if Jalen Hurts is not the guy, next year is supposed to be a much better quarterback class, much more deep, much more depth. You could use those two first-round picks, your second-round pick, to move up in the draft to basically get whoever you want. Or if the Saints are the worst team in the NFL, which isn't maybe a far cry, you could still select at a very high pick whatever quarterback you would want.
And by the way, Howie has signed another 3 years, right? Is that what I read in passing?
Which once that happened, I thought to myself, well, this guy, he can afford to say, which he said at the NFL owners meetings, you know, we're not all in. We're not in go for it mode. And once he said that, I said, well, it's all but confirmed as far as I'm concerned. They're moving a pick to next year. He signed that 3-year deal. It takes 3 years to grade a draft class, is what you always hear. So how is he to get those full 3 years? And probably another one, depending on what the next quarterback does that he'll draft. And I'm a Jalen Hurts guy. I like Jalen Hurts a lot. I love the mindset, love his work ethic and everything. Ultimately, I want to see him progress this year into being that franchise guy. But, man, like he did this year, he went up against a lot. And he's still going to have to be better than two first round picks next year, the money they're going to have to pay him after next year, if he is a franchise guy, which is another thing that's up against him, and then taking a team that has only barely improved their wide receiver position at this point to the playoffs. And he's got to improve his accuracy above everything. I know people want to talk about arm strength. Jalen Hurts needs to improve his accuracy before anything else, and also his ability to read the defense in front of him. He does that, and, yeah, we'll see what happens at the end of next year. But how he hedges his best is a smart play in case they do need a quarterback after this year.
Always love to tap the deep well, the font of sports knowledge that is Mark Farzetta every now and again, and we got plenty today. Mark Farzetta, you can hear him on the Farzi Show 6 to 7 a.m. every morning live, but you can catch it all day long. Twitch, Apple, yes. Spotify, FarziShow.com for all the links and information on how to reach out to Mark Farzetta. Great to talk to you, my friend. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, brother. Enjoy opening day. Go Phils.
Welcome to my world, she said. Separated world, she said.
Remember what we talked about? Fertilizer prices. The stupid old man let it out of the bag a couple of weeks ago. Food shortages. Yeah, they're going to be food. Oh, yep. Yeah, we talked about food shortages. Yeah, oh, yeah. Yep, that's going
to
happen.
With regard to food shortages, yes, we did talk about food shortages. And it's going to be real. The price of these sanctions is not just imposed upon Russia. It's imposed upon an awful lot of countries as well, including European countries and our country as well.
Yeah. From the Washington Examiner, for just the third time in recorded history, farmers will be planting more soybeans than corn. It's because soybeans put nitrogen back in the soil.
This is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Hey, Chris, good morning. I love you. You're awesome.
Hello, my sanity in the morning.
You got my adrenaline flowing before I even had my coffee here this morning.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
All right, real Pennsylvania, I know the heart and soul of working hard, playing hard Pennsylvania, and you need to have your heart and soul accurately represented by someone who stands up for God, family, country, Constitution, Bill of Rights, Ten Commandments, Golden Rule, that Pennsylvania work ethic, law and order. I know this guy. His name is Dr. Oz. And real Pennsylvanians should send Dr. Oz to represent their heart and soul in the U.S. Senate. Now is the time. Pennsylvania, let's celebrate the heart and soul of real Pennsylvania. God, family, country, Constitution, the Bill of Rights, uncompromised. Dr. Oz is your man. I know it, and you know it. Come on, real Pennsylvania, let's celebrate real Pennsylvania.
Ted Nugent weighing in on social media. That video, I'm not sure when that video was shot. I know last week I actually scanned the story that Ted Nugent had come out officially endorsing Mehmet Oz, Senate Republican primary candidate here in Pennsylvania, joins us again. And Dr. Oz, great to have you on the show. Welcome back, sir.
Chris, love being with you. Ted Nugent is something else. He did that spontaneously. He's a good guy. I'm actually going to see him in about a week. And he's been so passionate about the issues he feels our country faces. He gets maligned for it at times, but I think he's a patriotic American doing the best thing he can, speaking out.
You were part of a debate last week, and we played several clips. We talked with Dave McCormick. Bartos was there. Barnett was there. So it was the four of you on the stage. As I look at the Real Clear Politics average of polls right now, they have, and this is the average of polls, you know, they add them all up. They come up with the average. They have McCormick at 18.4, you just behind him at 17, and then Carla Sands at 9.8, followed by Barnett in fourth, Bartos in sixth. Are you pleased right now with where you see things standing?
I'm thrilled. After withstanding over $15 million of negative advertising, the most ever in a primary campaign that we're aware of, for me to still be tied, and you know that's an aggregate, but the most recent polls that I saw, one that just came out from Emerson, which I know you saw as well, that was in the news all last week, has actually, I was a tenth of a point ahead, which is statistically insignificant. It's a dead heat. It's going to be a tight race. The good news is Republican voters are animated when we do these town halls, and I did one last week out in Pittsburgh. We had hundreds and hundreds of people came out. Rick Perry endorsed me at that event, as well as the man who really invented the renaissance of American energy, Harold Hamm. And the folks are just, they're angry, they're frustrated. They're trying to channel the irritation of what Biden has done for the last 14 months into something that's productive. And I tell you, elections are a way of expressing yourself. These things, they're like therapy sessions. People don't come there for pep rallies. They're coming there because they're kicking the tires on what's going on with the Republican Party. And can they trust it to do what's right, what needs to be done, as Ted Nugent was saying.
Mehmet Oz with us running for Senate here in Pennsylvania as a Republican. Just because I haven't asked you, I've only talked with you one other time, and it didn't come up then. It came up after you visited with me, and I'll just address it, and then we can move on from it. Your citizenship became an issue, and you'd had dual citizenship. You and I didn't talk about it then, but I think there's been some, I don't know, maybe a change of view on your dual citizenship in Turkey. And I know that you'd spoken about your mother, who was ailing, and that was originally why you'd said you were keeping the dual citizenship. Where do you come down on that today?
Well, the dual citizenship issue is a distraction, and pretty transparently, it was an effort by my opponent, Dave McCormick, to make an issue of something that's not. There's no national security concerns. There are other people in Congress. Ted Cruz had a dual citizenship, so it's not a big issue. However, I don't want to distract voters from issues that matter. Just to be specific, my mom has Alzheimer's, so she really needs someone to manage her care. There's been mental health issues in my family as well, so I've got restraining orders on one of my sisters for my mom. It's a whole soap opera, but I wanted to maintain my ability to intervene personally within the legal system in Turkey, which is where my mom lives, and she does not want to come back to this country. All her family's there. She just, you know, when you have Alzheimer's, you don't want to change much. So I said, fine. And over the last couple of weeks, we've been talking as a family. We've come up with a workaround that's not ideal, but will be effective. My argument all along has been, I love my mom and I love my country, and I should be able to love both. But we've agreed that if elected before I'm inaugurated, I would give up my Turkish citizenship, so this would no longer be an issue in this campaign or going forward.
I am only asking this, and I want you. I hope you understand the place it comes from. I'm only asking it because when this story came up, I didn't know about it. I didn't care. It wasn't anything I was even thinking about. But someone wrote it in Inquirer, and I just don't know. It doesn't matter to me. I don't want you to interpret this as me asking it as some sort of litmus test. I'm asking just because I'm interested in you as a person. The Inquirer story in discussing your citizenship referenced you as Muslim. I didn't know that was true. And if so, I'm just curious, how does your faith inform your politics?
Well, first of all, you're a wonderful broadcaster, and you don't have to apologize for asking the right questions. It's fine. And I'm very proud of my heritage. We all should be proud of our heritage. My parents came to this country in the late 50s. My father was recruited as a doctor. We didn't have enough doctors at the time, and they're Turkish. And Turks are Muslims, 99%. So it's a rich heritage. I was raised a secular Muslim. I did the best thing in my whole life, which was to marry my wife when I was in med school at Penn, and actually married in the house I live in right now in Montgomery County. And she's a Christian, and she went to seminary. My mother-in-law is an ordained minister. Her great-grandfather built the church we live next to in Bernathen. So it's a pretty Christian family. We raised all of our kids, the four kids Christian, baptized them. All the grandkids are baptized and Christian. So I'm proud of who I am, typical American, raised with a proud heritage and welcomed into this country as my whole family was. It's one of the reasons, Chris, I'm running. My family could never have achieved what we did without America welcoming us, as this country always has. And we sometimes overlook what's so special about the shining city on the hill, as Reagan called us. But when you're in other countries, and my show, as you know, is a top health show for 13 years till I stopped in order to run, but it's in 100 countries. So I travel to these countries, and Muslim countries and Hindu countries and Christian countries and in Israel. So everyone sort of says the same thing. Fix America. Because yes. When we have our own internal issues, we look to you as our North Star. We need you to be healthy and prosperous so we can say we can copy that. It can exist on this planet. And I think my heritage gives me insights into that.
Does your faith inform your politics at all in your personal life generally?
Oh, my faith is very important. But my faith is in God and the power of a wisdom greater than I will ever have. And there's a humbleness that comes with that, but also a comfort. That in my time of pain and need, in our family, we pray. We have a chapel in our home, so it's pretty easy to go down there and just get solace and solitude.
Yeah, that's handy.
it's handy. And the Bible is a beautiful living document that comes alive. And in our faith, it's critically important. But remember, the people of the book, which are the Jews, then Christians, and then Muslims, all study the same theology. Their interpretations that differ, and I've been pretty aggressively against some of the things that have been happening in Turkey. And, if you really want to know, radical Islam is a horrible pox on the planet because they pervert the religion. And this is something that's recognized in other countries because it kills people. And we don't want that theology prospering. But the fundamental beauty of love and kindness to each other and the ability to get through. And that's why I said in the opening lines of when I first launched my show, with Sean Hannity, and Sean has endorsed me as well, as you know, I said, look into the divine spirit in each other's eyes. We have forgotten that at times. Don't get up in the morning and hate Democrats. Get up in the morning and realize that we're all special children of God and need to be respected, but also, helped along. Sometimes we get it wrong, and that's what we're supposed to do as a species.
Yeah, I want to be clear, just because I hope no one is left with the impression, you most of all, sir, that I'm making this a litmus test issue, your faith. It's just something that I had not even considered to ask you about, and because my faith is important to me, it's just interesting to me as a conversation piece, nothing more. Let me ask you about the transgender issue, Dr. Oz. It feels to me, just observing the news every day, it feels like all of the sudden this issue has become white hot, an aggressive cultural push on the transgender issue. And as a medical doctor and as a future, perhaps, United States senator, where do you see us going in this discussion in this country?
Too often Republicans take our 3x5 index cards into cultural war knife fights and we get slaughtered. This is not about, crossing a little T or dotting the right I in the legislation. This is a fundamental perversion of science, as a doctor, I'll speak to that, and puts our children at risk. So here's how I see it. I have done shows on transgender issues. I have tremendous empathy for adults who are transgender, very high instance of self-harm because they just feel like they're living a lie. I respect all that, and I try to address it as best I can. But I don't want people harmed, children in particular, because we have a woke ideology around transgenderism. The people who are the original sort of pioneers in this space agreed that the vast majority, probably 85% of young children who claim to be transgender will, if they're left to their own path and just given love, go back to their biologic sex. So a little 5-year-old walks around with his mommy's shoes, it doesn't mean he's transgender. It means he's walking around in his mommy's shoes and experimenting and figuring things out. And by the time he's a teenager, he's going to be a boy playing sports, and it'll make his life a lot more straightforward because he's not, you know, like struggling through this. But we have now adopted an ideology, again, as a scientist, I'll speak to this, an incorrect ideology, similar to what happened during COVID, that you must embrace a child who says they are transgender, distance them from their parents if necessary, because the parents won't understand, and what do they know anyway? And we, as the teachers and social workers, will embrace this child, sort of nurture them along their path to transgenderism, which is why you see a massive increase in the incidence of this diagnosis now. And I actually think that's harmful to kids. Especially it's harmful if you start to intervene in more aggressive medical ways. So as a doctor, I want to speak to these issues. And notice, Chris, let's just like you were asking very thoughtful questions in a kind way. We don't have to be aggressive or abrasive and mean-spirited about this. I'm asking, as a scientist, as a doctor, and as a father and grandfather, questions that people are worried about. And the vast majority of Americans agree. When you look at the cowardice that is shown in the face of this, it's stunning. And I'll point to Leah Thomas. You know, when she said, you know, I went to Penn Med Schools and Wharton Business School, so it's my alma mater. And normally I'm very proud of what Penn does. But this was a cowardly act to allow and don't let people control the language, a biologic male, they may be transgender female, but they're a biologic male, should not be able to beat up on biologic women. It goes against everything we've been trying to do with efforts to bring women's sports up to par, to allow women to benefit from sports like most of the listeners have, who are male and maybe played in high school or college. So why would you allow her to compete, have neither the university nor the NCAA say anything about it except to endorse and embrace her while she's, you know, wiping the pool with it, all the girls that she's who spent their lives trying to compete. And then it's the parents. It's, again, the parents who have to bravely step forward and say, this is wrong. We can do better as America. 80% of Americans, including Democrats, don't think that was right. But you can't raise your voice or you'll be canceled. That's what I've done my whole career. Speak up when people are being harmed and when they need someone to say something, because no one else will actually be able to say it. I fought on the biggest stage, Chris, like you, in media, because that's where we can fight the wokeness.
Mehmet Oz is with us. He's running for Senate here in Pennsylvania. I asked those that you're running against last week, right after the debate, I asked each of them, and I'll ask you too, is there a senator at present in the United States Senate with whom you most identify? Or you think if you became the next senator from Pennsylvania, you'd maybe like to work with or learn from or track with or say, I like their style?
I like Rand Paul because he's very analytic. I've had him on my show. I visited with him. He's a physician, ophthalmologist. But he's able to ask challenging questions, but he's tenacious at it. He doesn't just take the first answer. I like Tim Scott a lot because he's done a great job showing that the party is a big tent, that we can speak to everybody. And he's got a real passion when he speaks. And I like Rick Scott, the senator from Florida. And he's been a wonderful advisor, just sort of giving me insights about the human elements of being a candidate. But he also has a vision for what the party can do going forward. And listen, we may not all agree on the specifics of the vision, but, you know, you want to have a game plan, something that you're aiming towards. And I think he's tried to do that. And that'll, you know, these are the earlier steps that need to be taken. So when we take back the Senate in November, we have a very clear-eyed view of what to do.
Dr. Oz, since we last talked, the president of the United States was in Poland and said something remarkable, sort of off the cuff, and it's just stuck in my craw. I read from the Washington Examiner just this morning, more farmers are going to be planting soybeans. First time in, one of three times historically that farmers in the United States have decided they're going to start planting soybeans instead of corn because of the cost of fertilizer. And this president said a couple of weeks ago he anticipates food shortages. It's not getting the attention I think it due. It was sort of this glib, offhanded thing. And what do you think about that? Just generally in concept, that I don't want to alarm people or sound hysterical, but that's a remarkable thing for a United States president to say about our country.
Chris,
food shortage?
Yeah, Chris, I know. It caught me off guard too. And you're the first person to ask me about it. I was stunned. I mean, food shortages. And listen, Pennsylvania, 10% of our. Workforce, directly or indirectly, are in the farming space. We've got a lot of wealth above our soil as well as underneath our soil. We talk about the natural gas all the time, but the agricultural community is powerful. These are generally not massive farms. They're often family-owned, meaningful size, viable, but they need to be supported. And these guys are getting pushed to the curb. They cannot afford the gasoline prices, the energy prices, but they can't buy fertilizer now. So much of it's coming from from Russia, and Ukraine and Russia together, I think are, it's like number one and number four producers of grain in the world. So there it's going to be an issue. And you talk about social upheaval and unrest. It's one thing to have a 7.9% inflation rate, right? And it's another thing to have a devaluation where your currency is worth half the next day. But it's an entire different level of panic when you have a food shortage. And Maslow's scale, not to get into the deep psychology, but their basic human needs you must have, like shelter, food, or two of them. If you don't have shelter and food, everything crumbles. And the thin veneer of civilization will be cracked if we run into that, which is why aggressive stances to make sure that we shore up our infrastructure is so critical. And he's not doing them. We still are not able to drill for energy in federal lands. That's probably one-third of all the energy-producing land in the country. We still have not given our natural gas producers freedom from bureaucratic rules that don't make sense so they can actually start drilling. We can't build pipelines. Why don't we have a liquid natural gas facility here in Philadelphia, Chris? It would actually provide tremendous value to the city, lots of great jobs, and we'd help our allies overseas to be able to ship energy to them, drops energy prices, and farmers can plant again. It doesn't make sense that we're paralyzed, but it's because of a woke ideology. It's paralyzing Washington. They will not make the decisions because they don't want to irritate the green. And let me blow your mind with an idea. I've been struggling with why Biden can't just speak openly about the fact that that we need to become energy dominant again, like we were in the Trump administration. And I think it's because the basic far left belief is that we're a pestilence. We as humans are a pestilence, a cockroach on the planet, and that we're not going to do good. We're actually not a force for good, and therefore arming us with more energy and more ability to do things to develop is not a good thing. So they want to hold us back. That's why you notice some of the advice is, well, use less energy. That now it's going to be eat less food. It's, these are pretty toxic beliefs, but they're imbuing themselves into the very quilt of Democratic leadership. And that's why the Democratic Party has no agenda for prosperity. They're not taking us anywhere. They're trying to defend their moves against people who don't love America. You saw the data on how few Democrats would fight for the country if we were invaded last week, right? 40% said they would fight. 70% of Republicans said they'd fight. But how is that possible? Less than half of the Democrats would fight to defend their country because they don't think we're a force for good. We have to change that cultural narrative because it's false.
I know you have to run. I'll ask you one final question. On Title 42, this seems to me an opportunity for, I think, Republicans generally. I know a lot of people are talking about border security, rightly so. But here we've just talked about food insecurity. And there's still this thing called COVID out there. Maybe I'll ask you to weigh in, if you can, with some medical expertise in this answer at the same time. If COVID is still a genuine concern, how then do you justify opening our borders wide? Also, in the midst of talking about a potential food shortage, how do you justify opening our borders wide? I mean, it's contradictory on two fronts there alone, never mind security.
Chris, you said it beautifully. It's impossible. You create a logic pretzel where you're trapped in the sinews of these ropes that you thought were going to hoist you up with an argument that makes you seem virtuous and so reflective of how Democrats think about problems. Democrats care deeply about caring, but they don't focus upon the bigger issue, which is how do you care about fixing? And Title 42 is an example. First of all, why are you even thinking about that now? It's sort of like when Biden tried to fire me three times last week off the president's council. Why, in the middle of the Ukraine, inflation, highest gas prices in 15 years, now you want to fire me and Herschel Walker from the president's council when you haven't even convened the council since you became president? President Trump had appointed me twice. We had numerous meetings. Ivanka Trump ran. The president would actually get on the phone with us. Biden has done nothing. And then he takes – it's a political hit job. Just takes a shot at us. Why? A distraction? Why Title 42 now? We clearly are not through COVID in terms of its infectiousness. We have a new variant, the BA2, that's, again, I'm not worried about it being dangerous, but it's out there. So why would we welcome that into our country? It's insulting to Republicans and to Democrats that we would even begin talking about this now. We should be doing the opposite. Block the border, let no one across until they truly can prove they deserve asylum. Our legal system cannot cope with illegal immigrants who are allowed to be released into our society and never have to come back. And we're a border state. I'll tell you why. 100,000 opiate deaths last year. That's four times more than COVID deaths under the age of 50. Much of that caused because they're not just having cartels running humans on the border. They're actually, these cartels are running drugs. You can smuggle humans, you put drugs on them, you got fentanyl in the country, you kill people.
Dr. Oz, Mehmet Oz, he's running for Senate here in Pennsylvania. I know I said we were done, but just on COVID, do you feel like that's done as far as a mask lockdown vaccine requirement issue, or do you think that could flare up to a degree that we need to be concerned, or could you predict?
Well, I'll speak just as a physician who's looked at the data. You can't predict the future, as Wilkie Barre said. It just can't happen. But I don't believe that we're going to go back to the treatments that we had tried and failed with in the past. The mandates were utter disaster. I do think this virus has become endemic. By that, I mean it's going to continually spread like the flu does, continually. I mean, the flu is the descendant of the Spanish influenza, so it doesn't go away. I'm hopeful because so many of us have been exposed to COVID that there's a lot of natural immunity, which should be better than any other kind of immunity in case anyone tries to tell you otherwise. And I think that if the vulnerable population is vaccinated, and they have almost all been, Democrats never acknowledge it, but 95% plus of the older population is vaccinated and probably all have natural immunity if they weren't vaccinated. So we're in pretty good shape. But the virus is going to come around and it's going to hit people. And it's going to make you feel bad for 3 days. And then then you get back on your feet again. So the question is, will Democrats panic and start trying to do things that have the image of helpfulness, but really don't? And that's always where the rubber hits the road. Are you going to try to put masks on kids again when we know they don't work? Are you going to try to shut down schools again using kids as a shield when I've been proven over and over again it doesn't work? Will you silence dissent when people like me and other doctors say, wait a minute, hold a second, that doesn't make any sense, which is what Fauci did. That's why I've called for Fauci to be fired. That's who should have been fired when the president tried to fire me off the president's council. It should have been Fauci. Because anyone, think about this, if you hired a middle manager who had the results that he has obtained managing our COVID response, you'd fire him too. And he was political. He was actively involved in saying things prior to the 2020 election, which violates the Hatch Law.
Just over a month to go before the primary, Mehmet Oz is going to be on your ballot, Republicans, running for Senate. Thanks for your time today. I hope you'll come back.
Chris, I love speaking with you. Whenever you invite me, I'll be there. God bless you.
Dr. Mehmet Oz, it is 827. Telephone number 610-850-0990, 610-850-0990. Always love your reaction to conversations we have with these Senate candidates, 610-850-0990. You can email me, stay in touch at chrisstegall.com.
Gonna pay.
We went through this yesterday. The jobs report came out on Friday. Oh, more jobs created, more jobs created. And I say to myself, and so everybody needs more jobs just to pay the bills because everything is so damned expensive. This story today from the Washington Examiner that for one of only three times in history, let me make sure I've got this right. Hang on just a second here. Yes. Here's what it says. Washington Examiner this morning. For just the third time in recorded history, farmers in the United States will be planting more soybeans than corn as they grapple with the rising cost of fertilizer, a cost almost certainly passed on to consumers. Prices for some types of fertilizer cost a record $1,500 per ton. That's a 127% increase. Corn up 4%. By the way, corn, that's what we use to feed livestock, which you and I also buy and eat, which means that'll get more expensive. As a result, ready for this? 4 million fewer acres of corn will be planted this year, while soybean crops will increase by the same amount. And just the science behind it, soybeans put nitrogen back into the ground rather than extract it, so they need only a small amount of fertilizer when compared to corn. And remember when Biden warned of food shortages a couple of weeks ago in Poland. So I set all that up for our chief economist, Steve Moore, who's back with us. Freedom Works, senior economic contributor. He was an economist at the Trump White House. This, you know, I'm sorry. They keep talking about 440,000 jobs created. Steve, it's hard to be impressed with the news that I just gave you. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Chris. Well, it really is a good news, bad news story on the economy right now. I mean, the job market is very good for any worker who's looking for a job, so that's fantastic. I mean, if you've got a skill and you're looking for a job, you can find a job probably in 48 hours in most markets. So that's fantastic. And there's no reason, by the way, for people to be getting unemployment benefits and things like that now, because we can place people in the jobs that are available. There's 10 million jobs available out there. And part of the problem is we've been paying people not to work. And guess what? When you pay people not to work, you get less people working. And we still have very low, what's called labor force participation rate. That is to say, there's just still too many American workers on the sideline that need to be working. So that's on the jobs front, yeah, it's a good time to be working or looking for a job. But the inflation rate is eroding the value of just about everyone's paycheck. So, for example, in that report that you mentioned that came out Friday, the wages over the last year on average were up about 5 to 5.5%, which is in normal times a really good number, except that inflation was up 7.9%. So do the math, folks. That means that people were running behind by about 2.5 percentage points. In other words, what you could buy with your paycheck is actually 2.5% less than it was last year. And that's causing real hardship for people, especially people who have lower incomes. But I want to mention one other quick thing. If you're a saver, if you spent your whole life saving, Chris, so let's say, you know, you've worked for 40 years and you've built up, let's say, $500,000 of savings. Guess what? Guess what happens to your savings with this kind of inflation? Mm-hmm. It shrinks. It shrinks your savings. And that's not fair to people who've spent their whole life saving. So the inflation time bomb is real. It is not getting better. It's not transitory. And it's causing real harm. And I don't see a solution from the White House.
4.6% is the average home interest rate now on a home loan. And I was reading somebody say that they're actually kind of, not excited, but they're pleased with it only because home inventories can't keep up with demand. The market has been so hot that this will ultimately cool it. I mean, this when the Fed raises interest rates, as we've talked before, that's the point. They want things to slow down. They would like the housing market slowing down a little bit would be a positive development in the Fed's opinion. Is that correct?
Well, first of all, the mortgage rate has gone up a lot in the last 6 months, no question about it. So we're below 3%. Now we're up to 4.6 and rising. I lived through, a period when we had 17 and 18% mortgage interest rates. So in historical perspective, a 4.5 or even 5% mortgage rate is pretty low. But here's the problem, Chris. We've got this kind of very fragile, precarious economy right now that is slowing down. You've seen it in the GDP numbers showing that we only have about 1% growth now. And so we've got this raging inflation. And if the Fed raises those rates, it's going to slow down the economy even more and potentially throw us into a recession. But if they don't raise rates, we're going to see this inflation snowball just get worse and worse and worse. And that's why, boy, the American people get this. They don't need my analysis. You look at these polls, Americans are very, very pessimistic about the U.S. economy right now. They see the burgeoning debt. They see the inflation. They see the high gas prices. They see the housing market. And people are very fearful, as they should be, because this. And then on top of that, Chris, last week, since the last time you and I talked, Biden comes out with this dingbat budget calling for $2.5 trillion more taxes.
Which doesn't, I guess based on your count.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Why would you want to raise? We should be dramatically cutting government spending. He wants to actually continue to increase government spending. He's still peddling this Build Back Better bill. By the way, Chris, you and I spent, 9 months talking about that bill.
Yeah.
Can you imagine how bad inflation would be today if it were not for Joe Manchin saving the day? And,
well, that's what I was going to ask you. At FreedomWorks, by your guys' count at FreedomWorks, do you see there's any appetite or support? I mean, based on Manchin before, I can't imagine they have any support for that nonsense proposal. from last week, do they?
You never
I hope
know.
Not.
You know, Chris, I'm a big optimist, you know, as you know, but I say this, I will not believe that bill is totally dead until January 21st, when we take that gavel out of Nancy Pelosi's hand and she's no longer the Speaker of the House. Because, yeah, you know, Joe Manchin's saying all the right things. So far, he's done the right things. I think he's the man of the year. But what if he changes his mind?
Mm-hmm. Jamie Dimon, CNBC, has a piece. Dimon says confluence of inflation, Ukraine war may dramatically increase risks ahead. On this point, on the Fed and their spending, he said they did the right thing by taking bold, dramatic actions following the misfortune unleashed by the pandemic. In hindsight, it worked, but also in hindsight, the medicine, fiscal spending and quantitative easing, QE, was probably too much and lasted too long. So even he, who's a Democrat, said, yeah, it was too much injection of money into the system. So, I mean, you know, like when even he sees it and admits it, and he's a Democrat, right?
Well, I mean, look, this isn't, you think we might have spent a little too much money, Jamie? I mean, we got the highest inflation rate in 40 years. And come on, this is, I really regard what has happened since the beginning of the pandemic as really, truly one of the greatest failures of our government in history. We have a report coming out, by the way. You're there in Pennsylvania, and I know you have a lot of listeners in the New Jersey area. We rated how governors and states, dealt with COVID. And we looked at three variables, Chris. We looked at how did they do in terms of reducing the death rates from COVID? Did they keep people safe? That was the most important thing. Did, you know, how did they do in terms of making sure that people didn't die from COVID? Number two, how did they do in terms of keeping their businesses open and allowing their economies to continue to operate? And number three, did they keep their kids in school? Because we know, obviously, that a catastrophic error was shutting down schools. Shutting down schools never, ever should have happened, and kids were never at risk from COVID. And so what we found is that what state came out worst in the entire United States?
I got to believe we're in the running. New Jersey
was worse. Ooh. By the way, how in the world did New Jersey voters reelect your governor? I mean, well, my God,
barely.
It's like hiring a manager of a baseball team that lost 100 games. So New Jersey was by far the worst. New York was second worst. And Pennsylvania was not in the bottom. I think Pennsylvania was like eighth or ninth worst. So your states there did not handle this in a way that. And then you look at the states like, you know, were at the top, states like Iowa, states like Nebraska, states like Florida, that actually kept their economies functioning. They kept their people relatively safe. They didn't shut down their schools, and they've come out of this much better. So, we spent way, way too much money, and we're going to spend, you know, years and decades undoing the damage that was done from all of that government spending and the lockdown economies. Hopefully, we will never, the lesson of what's happened the last 2 years, never, never again. Never should we lock down our economy and our businesses and our stores and our restaurants and our schools and our churches. That was an outrageous overreaction, and it didn't do much good in terms of saving people from this killer virus.
All right, Steve Moore, professor, here we go. Teach me something. And you got to speak slow and dumb it down for me, because I know this audience is smart, but I'm not. This headline, Treasury yields invert as traders weigh U.S. recession risk. This at CNBC this morning. The bond market yesterday continued to flash warning signs the economy could be headed for a recession after Treasury yields inverted again. So I don't know. I've heard this asked of me before. Yeah. Inverted bond yields, and that indicates a recession. I don't know what that means, and I don't know why it indicates a recession. Can you explain it?
I can't, because, you know, this is a kind of a superstition on Wall Street, and I don't see the relationship. The fact that the longer term bond yield is falling a little bit now, I think, is a good thing, not a bad thing. I mean, look, would you want the 30-year Treasury bill to be at, you know, 6-8%? No. So I don't really understand. I've never understood the logic of, and I know people will say, well, this indicates that investors are getting bearish and so on. but I don't see it. Look, we don't have to get into those complicated formulations of a inverted bond yield. The risk is very simple, folks. We have a government spending that is out of control, spending trillions and trillions of dollars it doesn't have, and then it's borrowing the money and then it's printing the money to come up with the money to pay off the debt. That's a formula for economic disaster. It's as simple as that. We don't have to make this complicated, right? I mean, we've got to stop the spending in Washington. That's why when I kind of fell off my chair when I saw Biden saying, "Oh, let's spend trillions more." No, that is giving cigarettes to a cancer patient. No, no, no. Stop.
So you are not prepared to say the R word yet.
Complicated, Chris.
But you're not there on recession. You're not ready to go there yet.
Well, I'm not saying we may very well be headed towards this economic slowdown. What I'm saying is I don't think the inverted yield curve is the reason for it. I think the reason for it is we've got an out of control government spending. We've shut down our American energy, which is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. We should be drilling in states like Pennsylvania and West Virginia and Oklahoma and Texas and producing our own oil. And you've got turmoil around the world, and those things have really weakened the U.S. economy. So, are we at risk of a recession? Yes. I still think there's time to avoid it. But, as my buddy Larry Kudlow says, and he says it really well, don't despair. The cavalry is coming. Americans, the latest poll shows, generically, are you going to vote Republican or Democrat in November of 2022? The worst numbers for Democrats ever recorded.
Wow. Economic contributor.
Still the election, but the worst numbers for Democrats ever.
People He's at Freedom Works. Former Trump White House economist, and he checks in with us every single week. He's Steve Moore. My friend, always appreciate your time. Thank you.
Okay, Chris. Have a great week. Take care.
It's 848. Telephone number, 610-850-0990. Some reactions to the Dr. Oz conversation. Every time he comes on, it's fascinating to read what you have to say about him. And if you have anything to offer, you're welcome to dial us up, too, at 610-850-0990. I'll share some reviews. I'll say this about the Dr. Oz conversation. And this is just true. Don't get mad at me. But I just like to tell you the truth. Don't get mad at me. I can already hear people getting mad, banging away on their keyboards at me. What is true is that when Dr. Oz comes on this show, he elicits more reaction, negatively or positively, and there's a lot positive, to be very fair and clear. There are a lot of you that are very excited about this guy and like him a lot, and you like him more every time he's on. And I'll just say that when he comes on, he's consistently the guy that this audience seems to react to the most. That's not an editorial comment, that's just a statement of fact. Is that untrue, Fast Eddie?
No, it's not untrue. Be honest here.
React to. That doesn't necessarily mean all good. I'm just saying he evokes the most reaction.
I as soon as the show ends, that's when all the texts come in. Just, yes. He definitely.
So you take that for what you want. I don't know what that means to you. I'm just telling you that, all right? 610-850-0990.
Hey, it's Sebastian Gorka. Join me this afternoon at 3. Now, more on Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGar.
I just find it fascinating. I promise, folks, I'm doing my best not to editorialize in any way. All the Senate candidates are always invited, and when we get a chance to talk with them, we love to. We love to spend time with them, ask them the questions that we hear from you, and ask some that are on the top of my head. Here's some Twitter reaction, all right? 610-850-0990 if you care to weigh in. We talked with Dr. Oz. This was our, second visit with him?
It was, yep.
But I give them credit when we have spoken with them, they give us plenty of runway to talk. It's not like they rush off.
Correct.
He seems to be willing to be open and speak. So let's see. Jay on Twitter says, I like and I'm all in for Dr. Oz. He is great. We need him. He's giving up a guaranteed life of luxury for something he believes in, and that's huge. I like what he says and does. Hebrew Mafia on Twitter says, I don't know, Chris. I tried hard to like Oz, but he's so artificial. Pam says, I loved the Dr. Oz interview. Shelley says, he's a Trojan horse. Another great interview with Dr. Oz, writes another. Thank you. It's either between him or Carla Sands for me. I like her when I've heard her, but she needs to come on your show. Right now, for me, it's Dr. Oz. Friend of mine sent me a note and said, I think he's sincere. Said he's incredibly smooth. His answers are pitch perfect. But like Trump, some are wondering if he can be trusted. It's a friend of mine's text to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's concrete, rational thinking. His intellect is obvious. He's grounded by common sense. He's a star if he's legit. I mean, what do you do with this, Fast Eddie? I don't know. I'm just one man. This is all the communicating that I get from others. All right?
I understand. Yep. But understand, too, people are passionate about their other candidates. So I
know. They're all welcome. I'm not. None of this is an editorial stand I'm taking. I'm just sharing with you what other people are saying to me.
No, you've been.
Ed's in Lansdale. Ed, I'm glad you called. What do you say? Good morning.
Hey, Chris. Hey, thanks for taking my call. So I listening to the interview, I really like Dr. Oz. He's obviously smart. He's articulate. But listening to a couple of the ways that he answered your questions, one of the things was said that the Democrats care about caring. And then another thing was is that during COVID, they panicked. He doesn't understand who he's dealing with. I am voting for someone that knows who they're dealing with and is a mediator. The Democrats have no good intentions for any of us. He needs to understand that. But I like him. But I haven't decided yet.
This is really interesting what you're saying. You don't have any problem with the substance of his policy stands or any way he's answered anything. You just don't think he has the fight in him to label Democrats what they are.
It's obvious what they are. And you can't trust people that are untrustworthy.
And you fear that he's willing to be too deferential or give Democrats the benefit of the doubt based on his answers.
Yes, I do. And unfortunately, the way politics are, that way of thinking, we have to really take things for what they are now. We can't think that way. Have an enemy.
Who are you leaning toward at this moment?
I have not decided. I love that you interview all these candidates. It's so helpful. And I'm going to go back and listen to all your interviews. So if he ends up being the candidate, then of course I am going to vote for him. But I want someone who understands who they're dealing with.
Ed, thank you. We've had two very thorough interviews now with Dr. Oz, at least a couple with McCormick, several with Kathy, a few with Jeff, three with Carla Sands.
Yep, and two with George Baquetto as well.
And George Baquetto as well. So where can people... Are those people just have to search those? Is that right, Eddie? For Senate candidates?
Yeah, they're all podcasts at 990theanswer.com. Click Chris's podcast page for this show, and then you'll be able to search within there, like on the podcast page. Search the name, and there you'll see the interviews.
Okay. And then on the gubernatorial side, we're interviewing all of them too. Next Monday, our Facebook Live with Jake Corman. And then the following Monday, our Facebook Live with Doug Mastriano. Then our final Facebook Live the following Monday with Dave White. So, trying to cover all the bases before the primary.
This is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. 3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn.
deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.